Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our memorial service here at Hyde Park. And we also welcome those who are listening online as well. And the exhort is Brother Sam Mansfield. There's a lovely verse from Psalm 34, which you'll be aware of. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him, and he delivers them. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the one who takes refuge in him. So maybe there's something there that can encourage us this morning, as well as an exhortation from our Brother Sam. And his theme is ascending. To introduce Brother Sam Mansfield's words this morning, read John 14. And we're going to have the exhortation now from our Brother Sam Mansfield, which is entitled Ascending. So hopefully he doesn't end up on the ceiling.
Thanks, Graham, and good morning, everyone. So, question for you to start with, and this is not rhetorical, I'm interested in your answer. How many times do you think Moses climbed Mount Sinai to receive the law from God? Does anyone know, or anyone got any guesses as to how many times he does it?
Twice.
Oh, any advance on twice? Yeah, Benny's got it. So I think the answer is seven. It's a little bit obscure in the record to know how many times he's actually gone up and down. But yeah, I think I went through it and the answer seems to be seven to me. So that's a bit of a surprise, I think, from what we consider about Moses going up and down Sinai. I guess the next logical question is, what's that got to do with John chapter 14? So part of what I think John is trying to do in his gospel is show that Jesus doesn't just fulfill the Old Testament and, you know, all the events and all the Psalms and all the prophecies and all those people whose lives foreshadow that of Jesus. Jesus not only fulfills that, but goes way beyond what was, you know, sort of even foretold or surpasses anything that occurred in the Old Testament. So, for example, pretty well known, you know, John chapter 1, the first couple of verses, in the beginning was the Word, all things are made by him. So it's a clear reference back to the Genesis creation. But I think what John is revealing for us in John chapter 1 is that this new creation, this new spiritual creation, is far superior to the creation of Genesis chapter 1 and 2. And of course, in this new creation, there isn't just one Adam. We can all become the sons of God. So John's gospel is a bit like the book of Hebrews. Book of Hebrews, which senior Sunday school class started looking at this morning, demonstrating that Christ is, you know, greater than the angels, greater than Melchizedek, greater than Abraham, and significantly for us this morning, I think, greater than Moses and the law that he delivered to Israel. So I think in the words of Jesus, which is most of the words of John chapter 14, John is deliberately setting up this sort of compare and contrast situation for us. And that comparison, that contrast, is between Jesus and what he was about to do in his death, resurrection, and particularly his subsequent ascension up into heaven, and what Moses achieved through his ascensions up to Mount Sinai. So the aim of religion, the aim of atonement, at-one-ment, is obviously in the meaning of the word. So religion means to bind together, ligaments hold things together. Atonement means to make at-one, at-one-ment. So it's about bringing humanity and God back together again. And really it's about bringing humanity back to God. So God obviously doesn't need to move. It's us that needs to change and come back to him. And this is Jesus' stated aim in John's gospel. So just come across to John chapter 17. So you'll know that I think that sort of this whole section from John 13 right through for the next few chapters is all one sort of discourse around the Last Supper and the subsequent journey to the garden. So John chapter 17 and verse 21. And this is the point of everything, really. That they, that's us, all may be one. as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they, that's us again, along with, you know, all the other believers down through history, they may also be one in us. So this idea of oneness, bringing us up to God's level, making us one with God, is what the whole thing is about. So in John chapter 15, it's about abiding, you know, living with. So that's an idea of being together with someone, isn't it? So this repeated idea in John 15 is about abiding, dwelling, living with. So John 15 verse 4, abide in me and I in you, words you probably know pretty well. Live, dwell, stay in me, says Christ, and I will dwell, live, stay in you. We'll be at one. There'll be no distance between us. Which brings us to what God was aiming to do in giving the law to Moses back in Exodus and Leviticus. So God tells us through Moses, why don't we come back there? Come back to Exodus, and we're going to spend a little bit of time in Exodus. So Exodus 25 and verse 8. Exodus 25 and verse 8, God says to Moses here, let them make me a sanctuary. So it's obviously going to be the tabernacle that was going to be made by Israel, that I may dwell among them. So this idea of dwelling with, staying with, abiding with, right back here in Genesis 25 verse 8. The idea of God dwelling with us, the same as John chapter 15. Cross a few pages to Exodus 29 verse 45. God says here, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will be their gods. So again, this idea of God living with people, with humanity. So the aim is the same, God dwelling with humanity, abiding with us. God and humanity united as one. Religion, atonement, is sort of achieved there. So Moses' seven ascents and descents were to try and achieve this. And it failed spectacularly. So we're going to see the contrast between Jesus' ascent up into heaven, which succeeded far more spectacularly than Moses even failed. So start thinking about this process and the reasons that Moses made all those climbs up Mount Sinai. While we just highlight a few ideas about what John tells us, or Jesus tells us through John in John chapter 14. So Trevor's just read it for us, so you'll remember it. John 14 verse 2, in my Father's house, so there's the idea of a house, a dwelling place, are many mansions, as it says in the AV. So many abiding places, many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would have told you, I go to prepare a place for you. So Jesus in John chapter 14, in 43 days after that, was going to ascend up into heaven, wasn't he? To be with the Father in God's dwelling place. And he says, in heaven, up in God's dwelling place, there are heaps of room for people to dwell in. People can dwell with God. There's plenty of rooms, plenty of spaces. We each have a place up there. So just to be clear, we're not talking about going to heaven physically when we die. We're talking about a new spiritual relationship, a new spiritual oneness with God. John 14 verse 3, Jesus says, if I go up to heaven to be with the Father and prepare a place for you, so he's preparing a place, or has prepared a place for us, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. So there's so many places for us to abide, to dwell up in heaven. Christ is going to ascend up into heaven, he says, who tells his disciples, then come back down and take us up to be in heaven with him and with the Father. And then we'll be living, dwelling, staying with Christ and God. We'll be at one with them. Atonement will be achieved. So again, we're not dwelling, abiding physically in heaven, but spiritually, Jesus has promised that he has and will lift us up there. He has lifted us up there, as Paul tells us in Ephesians 2 verse 6, and he's already done it, raised us up together and made us sit together in heavenly places in Christ Jesus. By Ephesians 2, it has been achieved. We are already sitting up there in heavenly places with Christ Jesus. So one ascent up to the Father, and then Jesus says, I'm going to come back down and bring all of you, all of us, up with him. So now, think about poor old Moses, and he was quite old, if I can, you know, use that term. He was 80 years old at this stage. It's not that old. It's quite old. Quite old to be climbing up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, up for 40 days, then back down again, up again, down again, up for another 40 days, and then down the mountain again. And for what? Well, it's going to be precious little, as we're about to see. At no stage is Moses able to bridge that gap between the people and God. At no time do the people climb up the mountain and ascend up to be with God. There's no atonement achieved. God and his people are never at one. God is always at the top of the mountain, apart from right at the end, which we'll explain in a minute, and the people are always at the bottom. So come back to Exodus chapter 19 and see how this distance is really emphasised, this distance between God and people is really emphasised here. So in Exodus 19, you know, Israel's made it to Mount Sinai. You know, they've just fled from Egypt. They've crossed the Red Sea. And here they are ready to meet God in the wilderness. So Exodus 19, verse 17. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God. So this is the whole plan here, isn't it? For people to meet with God, to atonement, be at one with God, meet with him. And they, the people, stood at the nether part of the mount. So we've got our purpose here, a meeting between people and God. And the purpose is this atonement, at-one-ment. But does this meeting ever actually happen? Well, the answer is not really. The people stay at the bottom, at the nether part of the mountain, as verse 17 says. So by this verse, by verse 17 of Exodus chapter 19, Moses has actually been up and down the mountain twice. So once in verse 3 of Exodus 19, and then again in verse 8 of Exodus 19. So he's already been up and down twice. And notice how verse 3 phrases it so simply. Moses went up unto God. Now, is that not exactly the picture of what we read in John chapter 14? I ascend up to the Father, says Jesus. Moses is, in type, ascending up into heaven, into God's presence, just as Jesus does after his death and resurrection. God is at the top of the mountain. The people are at the bottom of the mountain. Moses is going up and down between them. And God has told him in no uncertain terms that none of the people are to climb the mountain into God's presence. So verse 12 of Exodus 19, thou shalt set bounds upon the people round about, saying, take heed to yourselves that ye go not up into the mount or touch the border of it. Don't even touch the bottom of it. And whosoever toucheth the mount shall surely be put to death. Verse 13, there shall not an hand touch it, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through, whether it be beast or man, it shall not live. When the trumpet soundeth long, they shall come up to the mount, but not up into the mount. So not only can they not climb to the top of the mountain, they can't so much as touch the base of the mountain. So that's our first big contrast, isn't it? Jesus ascends up to heaven, and then comes down, he says in John 14, and collects us and brings us up into the presence of God with him. Moses does not. He cannot bring the people up the mountain into the presence of God. It's like God is saying, this mountain is evidence that there is never going to be oneness between me and you as a nation. There will always be separation because, apart from Moses, you can't ascend the mountain to my presence into heaven, as it were. Moses is not allowed to bring anyone with him. The people he represents can't even touch the mountain, let alone climb it with him. So Moses has no power to achieve that oneness between God and Israel. Christ, on the other hand, of course, has the power to achieve oneness between God and all of humanity, not just Israel, if all of humanity takes him up on the offer. So does Jesus' ascent far exceed Moses' ascent? Already we can see that it does. So to underline this impossible distance between God and Israel, the impossibility of Moses bridging that gap between them, just look how the mountain is described in verse 16 of chapter 19 of Exodus. So there's thunders and lightnings, there's this thick cloud upon the mount, there's the voice of a trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Verse 18, Mount Sinai was on a smoke because Yahweh descended upon it in fire. The smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace. The whole mountain quaked greatly. So it must have been an awesome sight, I guess. All the senses are involved in it. Perhaps not taste. Oh, no, I guess you can taste smoke. Sight, you know, with fire and lightning and smoke. Sound with the trumpet sounding like an alarm, louder and louder. Smell with, you know, smoke and sulfur. Touch, as you know, the whole earth is around the mountain is trembling and shaking. So any one of those things would have been pretty terrifying, but all combined, it's an overwhelmingly terrifying vision. So this relationship, I guess, or lack of relationship, is based on fear, isn't it? So God reveals himself in this terrifying awesomeness to the point that the people say over in chapter 20 and verse 19, they said to Moses, "Speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die." And Moses has to say to the people, "Fear not, for God has come to prove you." So the overwhelming emotion that comes out of this attempted non-meeting with God for Israel is fear, isn't it? What sort of relationship can be built on that? Well, probably not a lasting one, as we know. And yet, John is the one to tell us that God is love, and perfect love casts out fear. So we're not going to go into too much more detail about Moses' ascents and descents on Mount Sinai, but I do just want to pick up a few key points that between the very, you know, the differences between Moses and Christ's very different ascents into God's presence, because the differences and the comparisons don't stop there. So just think about what Moses does achieve. What does he bring down from the mountain for his people? And then we're going to see that what Christ also promises us as a result of his ascent in John chapter 14 onwards. So the first thing, of course, most famously, that Moses brings down from the mountain are commandments. Moses comes down the mountain with, you know, the Ten Commandments, first receives them in Exodus 20, which I think is his third ascent, and he passes them on orally to Israel. Then he receives the commandments written by God in stone in Exodus 31, verse 18. And then he smashes those ones at the foot of the golden calf, and he has to take up his own stone tablets up into the mountain for God to rewrite the commandments on after he smashed the originals. So commandments, an important part of what Moses brings down from the mountain and gives from God to Israel. Moses also receives assurance from God that he will send something to help them. God says, "I'm going to send something to help you. I'm going to send an angel, in fact, to help you." Just come across to Exodus 23 and verse 20. And here God tells Moses, "I'm going to send you something." Verse 20 of Exodus 23. "Behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared." So God is going to send something to help Israel in their conquest of the promised land. And God also gives Moses plans for the tabernacle, a house, a dwelling place, doesn't he? Exodus 25 and verse 8, come over to there. I think we've already read this one. A dwelling place, Exodus 25 verse 8, "and let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them." Now, the tabernacle, a dwelling place definitely, with how many rooms? Basically one room to dwell in, wasn't it? One room for God to dwell in, one room for God to dwell in that could only be entered in once a year by one man according to the law. Certainly not a house of many abiding places for all of us to live in with God. And in the end, right at the end of Exodus, because the people can't ascend the mountain, God does, you know, in type, I guess, come down to their level to dwell with them. So just come across to the end of Exodus and chapter 40, after all these trips up and down the mountain, at the end of the book, Exodus 40, verse 34. They've built this tabernacle for God, and then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, Exodus 40, verse 34, and the glory of Yahweh filled the tabernacle, and Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation because the cloud abode, so notice that abiding with sort of phrase, God is abiding with Israel, the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. So even this sort of image of God meeting with Israel in the tabernacle, even though it's extremely limited, no, Moses can't even go in there himself, God can't, sort of apart from Moses, get Israel to climb the mountain, to ascend to the spiritual heights that he wants them to ascend to, does he? It's almost like in order to form a relationship with them, God has to lower himself down to their level. And even at that level, he's, you know, still hid in his glory, he's unseen by most of them in the most holy place. None of Israel can actually go into the most holy place to meet with God, except the high priest alone, one day each year on the day of at-one-ment, atonement. There's still all these barriers, isn't there, between Israel and the God who chose to dwell with them. They do actually see God. So this is another just interesting aspect in comparison with John 14. A very few, select few of them, see God. In Exodus 24, verse 9 and 10, then went up Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. So that's Exodus 24 and verse 9 and 10. And there were under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone. So that's pretty amazing, isn't it? They see God. But it's not a very complete picture, is it? Of all of, you know, heaven, as it were, that they see, all that's described here is the floor of heaven. It's like they sort of have this glimpse of God in his dwelling place, a glimpse of heaven, but just of God's sort of feet, just of where he's standing, of the floor of heaven, as it were, not a very complete picture of it. And as part of that, in Exodus 24, verse 11, they eat and drink. They have a fellowship meal with God, just the 74 of them. A fellowship meal, a bit like what's happening, of course, in John 13 and 14, a bit like what we're doing this morning. But there's still this distance between God and them. And again, it's emphasised after that happens that Moses alone is allowed to ascend higher up the mountain and approach near to God. Even those special 70 plus four others were not able to, you know, ascend the mountain with Moses. So Moses' attempts at bridging this gap between the people at the bottom of the mountain and God at the top are, you know, futile in the end, aren't they? No matter how many ascents and descents he makes, Moses cannot make God and his people one. He can't make them dwell with God and God dwell in them, not just among them, but in them. There's quite a big difference. So Moses cannot achieve this at-one-ment that John talks about. But just keep in mind what he does in his toings and froings up Mount Sinai. So he has plans for a one-room dwelling place, the tabernacle. He's got assurance from God that he will send assistance in the form of a guiding angel. He has a commandment, or 10 commandments, 10 big ones, and then heaps of pages of little commandments. Moses and the 70 elders see God, but in the end it's Moses alone that meets with God. And that the people and God have this relationship based on fear, just on how awesome God is in his revelation to them. So just come back to John chapter 14 and we'll see, as you've probably already noted, how far Jesus' ascent surpasses Moses' efforts. So we've already seen that Jesus makes us one with God and with the Father. So gone is that great distance between us and the Father that existed between Israel and God. We've seen that Jesus prepares a tabernacle for us in heaven. Instead of God having to descend to earth to dwell with Israel in a tabernacle they built on earth, Jesus lifts us all up into heaven to dwell with God. And not in a tabernacle with just one room, it's a place with many abiding places, as John 14 verse 2 says. There's room for everyone. Anyone who wants to be there will have a room there. Jesus does not ascend alone. He returns and brings us up into heaven directly with him. So verse 3 of John chapter 14, I'll go and prepare a place for you. I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. Something Moses could not do. Moses ascends to God's presence alone. Our Lord brings us up with him. We are elevated into heaven to meet with the Father and the Son, to dwell with the Father and the Son. So remember that Moses and the 70 elders saw this limited vision of God in heaven for a brief time. John chapter 14, verse 8, Philip says to him, Lord, show us the Father, and it sufficeth us. Jesus saith unto him, Have I been so long a time with you, and yet thou hast not known me, Philip? He that hath seen me hath seen the Father. So we can gaze on the Father in the person of his Son at any time, for as long as we like. It's not just some brief glimpse that Moses and the 70 elders saw at Sinai. We can read about a man who perfectly reflected his Father's character. We can see God. What about commandments? Well, we know Moses received 10 commandments from God and pages of other little commandments. Well, Jesus receives not 10, but one commandment from the Father. And he hints at that in John chapter 14 and verse 31. As the Father gave me commandment, even so do I. And Jesus doesn't have to climb a mountain to find out what this commandment is. He doesn't have to ascend up into heaven. He already knows exactly what this commandment is. He tells his followers, he tells us that one commandment before he ascends up into the mountain, as it were. It's a commandment that, when he says these words, hasn't actually been completed in him, fulfilled. It's not fulfilled until he is crucified. It's a commandment that can't be complete, fulfilled until he is crucified. And that's why I think he saves that revealing of his one commandment until this night of his trial, leading into the day of his crucifixion. And what is that commandment? I think you know it already. John 15, verse 12. This is my commandment. This is my one commandment, says Jesus, that ye love one another as I have loved you. As I have loved you. And Jesus' demonstration of how complete that love is not fully revealed until he voluntarily lays down his literal life on the cross. Love each other this much, says Jesus from the cross. One commandment. What could be simpler? So this one commandment replaces the 10 written in stone, the hundreds written in Exodus and Leviticus. Love each other like I have loved you. How much does he love us? Well, that wouldn't be fully revealed until he hung on a cross a few hours later. Love each other like this. So one simple commandment for us to follow, as opposed to the thousands of complicated commandments in Exodus and Leviticus. One simple commandment. How are we going with that? So love is the basis of our relationship with the Father and with the Son and with each other. That relationship with Israel and God was based on fear, wasn't it? Which relationship is more likely to last forever? Finally, Moses was promised that God would send him something. I will send an angel, God told him. And Jesus does the same for us, doesn't he? He says, I will send a comforter. So John 16, verse 7, if I go not away, the comforter will not come unto you. But if I depart, I will send him, it, unto you. And that comforter remains with us, not least of all in the form of the Bibles on our laps. So we can see how John is showing us that this sort of far surpassing excellence of Jesus' ascent into heaven compared to Moses. So what I want to sort of finish off with in the last couple of minutes is that incredible blessing that we have in this relationship, this at-one-ment, this oneness that we have with God through Christ's ascent. So the closeness, the directness of our relationship with God is one, you know, incredible aspect of it. So back in Exodus, we've got Moses climbing Sinai, God giving him some instructions for the people, Moses clambering back down the mountain to tell the people, you know, this is what God said. Then the people would respond and Moses would reclimb the mountain to hear God's response to the people's response. So what kind of communication channel is that? It's obviously a very indirect, a very slow one. Just read John chapter 14, verse 3 one more time. If I go, says Jesus, and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself, that where I am, there ye may be also. This is where we are now, not left at the base of a terrifying mountain, but transported with Christ into the presence of the Father. And the incredibleness of this blessing is really highlighted by contrasting it with the relationship with Israel and Moses. Their perspective of God was, you know, this awesome, almighty, powerful, loud, earth-shaking God, and he is all of that. But to them, he was always distant. There was always a barrier, a mountain. Their own fear was a barrier. You know, the veil in the tabernacle and temple, that was a barrier. But now, through his Son, he is our Father. We are all his children. A loving, caring, providing God is who we serve, in whose presence we serve. So that father-child relationship is a very different relationship, a much closer relationship. So in the Gospel of John, the term Father is used 134 times, and all but 9 of them refer to God as the Father, more than double that of Matthew or Luke, 4 times that of Mark. So this is a new relationship, isn't it? Far exceeding that relationship that Israel as a nation had with God. So if Christ ascended up into the mountain, into the presence of God, into heaven, and then returned and has taken us up to where he is, then we are there too, aren't we? We are living life in the presence of God, in the presence of his Son. We are living heavenly lives. We are living in the presence of God every day, all the time. So how does an awareness of that impact what we do each day? How does it impact what we say, what we watch or click on or tap, or what we listen to, how we speak to our co-workers, how we drive our car, what we say to other drivers on the road in our car? So we're conscious of always being in God's presence, in Jesus Christ's presence. I think we will live more deliberate lives. And on the other hand, as we've seen over our last few Sundays, if we are always in God's presence, he is right there to protect us. He is right there to guide us. He is right there if we need to ask for something or just tell him something. We have instant access to the throne of grace, like someone living full time in the most holy place in the temple or the tabernacle. Every day for us is a day of atonement. The mercy seat's right there. We can touch it. We don't need to shout to be heard by the Father or by the Son. They are right there with us. So we're about to demonstrate the closeness of our relationship in the eating of Christ's flesh and the drinking of his blood. John 17, verse 23 tells us Christ is in us. The Father is in the Son, so that we may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that the Father sent Jesus, and that he loves us as he loves his Son.